Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. Thanks for joining me for TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, a chance for you to enjoy complete conversations from our TCM archives with guests who have appeared on our private screening shows. When we do these interviews, I usually sit with guests and talk for at least a couple of hours, but out of that, only about an hour or less makes it to the air. So Private Screenings Uncut is a chance for you to hear the whole conversation uncut. This particular installment is among my personal favorites because it gave me a chance to talk to a woman whose life story is really inspirational. It's Patricia Neal, an Academy Award winner and a lady whose career on stage and screen was amazingly successful, but interrupted by a string of personal tragedies, which would have defeated most people, but has never stopped her. She suffered a series of strokes which nearly killed her and left her debilitated, but Patricia Neal has never been one to let something like an illness keep her down. She fought back from her ailments, and soon after she started working again, and after that tragic turn in her life, went on to earn another Academy Award nomination. When she sat down with me in December 2003, Pat and I talked about her health problems. We also talked a lot about her amazing career, which started on the Broadway stage when she was still a teenager. Soon after, Warner Brothers put her under contract and began teaming her with some of the movie's top leading men, such as Ronald Reagan, John Garfield, and a man who had become very important in Pat Neal's private life, Gary Cooper. Now, Cooper was a married man, but he and Pat had become involved in a relationship which caused quite a scandal and eventually had a big impact on Patricia Neal's career, basically ending her work opportunities in Hollywood and sending her back to the New York stage, where she once again began working. She speaks very frankly about her relationship with Gary Cooper, as well as the aftermath of that relationship. And she's also very honest about some of the other leading men in her life, some of whom she liked and some of whom she most certainly did not. Pat also goes into her thoughts about some of her most famous films, such as The Fountainhead, HUD, The Subject Was Roses, A Face in the Crowd, and The Day the Earth Stood Still, all that and a lot more. So here, the audio track from a show first shown on TCM in June of 2004 and now brought to you in its complete uncut form. Here's TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Patricia Neal.
Am I gaudy? Am I too gaudy?
No, no, you're showbiz. You can get away with it.
I hope.
Ah, okay. We're going to start.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, it's so nice to have you here. We've been wanting to do this for a long time.
I'm very happy to be here. I'm flattered that you asked for me.
Well, we're delighted to have you here for many, many reasons. You are a great, great actress, a wonderful actress. And I know that you're sometimes concerned or have been concerned, and rightfully so, that sometimes your personal life is talked about more than your acting and everything.
But that's right.
I just want to say how wonderful your acting is, how well it stands up, and how great to have those films that Patricia Neal stars in.
Well, not all that much. Ingrid Bergman, she was better than me. She got much better films, and so did Katharine Hepburn and all the others. I'm the second lot, which I like.
Did you always want to be an actress? Was that always in your bones?
Well, when I was about 11, I went to church, the Methodist church, and I saw a glorious lady giving monologues. That's what I wanted to do, was give monologues. Well, my father's boss's daughter, she just came back from New York, and she taught drama lessons. And I wished for it for Christmas, and they gave me a note saying, you may study drama. And I wanted to give monologues and for years. And then I saw a play in Knoxville, and I fell in love with this man in it, and I so badly wanted to do it. So I joined it, and I got great notices the first play that I did. And I know that he took me to the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia. And oh boy, I knew I wanted to be an actress.
So did you have any theater in your background or your family?
No, none.
Little girl from Knoxville, Tennessee, right?
That was me.
And what about your folks? Were they theatrical in any way?
No. My father, he worked for the coal company, and my mother, she was the daughter of a doctor, and nobody.
Did they encourage you?
Oh yes, they were thrilled. They, you know, they liked the idea of me giving monologues all over the place.
So soon after you went off to Northwestern when you were off to college, and was that an important thing? Because Northwestern is one of the great drama schools,
well,
right?
I did want to go there. I chose it, and my daddy died my first year at Northwestern. He died of a quick heart attack. And I didn't want to go back, but they insisted I go back for another year. And I studied with dear Alvina Krauss, a great teacher. And and she decided to take me to her summer theater, which she was starting that year. And that was in Elitch's Gardens in Pennsylvania. And then from there, I went to New York. And I got a job so quickly. I was there about 2.5 months until I got a job understudying Voice of the Turtle. And oh, he was a divine man, Alfred Deliagra.
The producer.
Really, yes, when he was, yes, the producer. And he really was so delicious to me. When I know that I left to do another play, and that closed in Boston, and I got a telegram from him saying, come back to us, and he sent me to Chicago. And I played the older woman, you know, the actress or
in
something.
In Voice of the Turtle.
Yes, I played her. I know that the one who played, what is her name?
Ethel Mertz, Vivian Vance.
Vivian
Didn't
Vance.
You replace
you
her?
You are so good. Well, I took over until they got a older woman. I was 19 that to take her place. And oh, it was so great. I loved it. And then I came back to New York and studied again. And I played it once more, that same part.
So that you had a meteoric rise in the theater then, for starting out so young and so quickly.
Oh, I wanted to be I didn't want to be a film actress. I wanted to be a stage actress. And then I got in another part of The Forest, which was Leon Hillman's The Little Foxes was first, and then another part of The Forest. And we thought it was going to be the hit of the world. We really did. We thought it was going to be bigger than anything, bigger than Little Foxes. But it wasn't quite.
But it was a great success for you.
Oh, yes.
You won the first Tony Award
yes,
ever given.
Yes, the first newcomer.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was a great success for you. And out of that came Warner Brothers, right?
No. After that, I signed a contract for 2 years, and I went to Denver, Colorado, the leading lady at Elitch's Gardens. Did I say Elitch's before? I think I did. I was wrong about being there. I had a lot of parts, and I learned them, and then I went on the road with another part of The Forest, but it did not last long, so I was without a job, and I thought I'd go to California because they had lots of offers.
So you were offered a contract, I believe, by Goldwyn, by Selznick, MGM wanted you, 20th Century Fox, Paramount, and you picked Warner's. Why did you pick Warner Brothers?
Well, my agent said to pick it. You know, anything they said, I did.
Did that surprise you at all, that all this was happening, like, so quickly, so fast?
Oh, no, I expected it. Isn't that crazy? One's an idiot, you know. But I did, and things went very well for many years.
Your first picture was John Loves Mary with Ronald Reagan, and you'd actually been offered that role on the Broadway production, right?
I had.
And you chose to do another part of The Forest instead.
Now that was interesting because the producer, Richard Rodgers.
Richard Rodgers, right?
Yeah, the Richard Rodgers. He saw me in the, where am I talking about? In Connecticut, you know, the Theater Guild.
The Westport Playhouse.
He saw me there, and well, he liked me, and he kept trying to put me in things. And then I had gotten John Loves Mary. And I had not signed a contract. And then I went to the theater, which I was understudying.
John Loves Mary for the New York production, right?
Yes. I was, And then I went to the theater where I was understudying, and this female agent, she was on in the alley, and she said to me, would you like to read for Leland and Hellman? And I said, oh, I can, I've got a job. And she said, oh, please, you must. So I said, okay, I will. And I read for it, and I got it immediately. So I chose Another Part of the Forest, and Richard Rodgers was a little disappointed, but I hadn't signed, and he said, you want much too much money. Well, not a lot. So I told him that I had another job.
So that was quite incredible. You got to do John Loves Mary after all anyway.
I did.
Do the movie version.
I wasn't very good in it.
Well, that was a part that maybe didn't fit you as well as the big one that came right after.
That's right.
Because then came The Fountainhead.
Yes, I love doing The Fountainhead.
Yes. Talk about that a little, how that came about. Because that's a part that everybody in Hollywood wanted, particularly Barbara Stanwyck. I think she thought she had a lock
boy.
On it.
She was furious when I got that part. But the dear director, whose name was
King Vidor,
he's the one that I was walking with Warner Brothers, walking along the streets of it, and this man passed on a bicycle. And he looked at me and he stopped and we began to talk, and I don't know, we talked about 20 minutes. And then he said, I'd like you to test for The Fountainhead. Oh God, I was thrilled. And I told everybody, I told the one who'd done my costumes, everybody. And that was terrible, because the woman who he'd employed to do the costumes, he was so furious, the producer, that he fired her. I mean, it was terrible.
You got the part?
Yes, I got the part, and I was so thrilled. That's when I was telling everybody about it. Too many people.
Now, at this point, had you met Gary Cooper, who was signed for the lead for it?
Oh, yes. I know that King Vidor, he introduced me to Gary Cooper, and he very liked the idea of me doing. And then I tested two tests. One wasn't very good, I was told, and the other one was super. So I did it, and then I know that I met Gary Cooper when Jack Warner, he had a great luncheon party at his place to eat, whatever it's called. And I liked him very much.
Gary
he sat
Cooper.
Across the table. He didn't pay any attention to me, but I liked him. And then I met him at Jack Warner at the director's office, and then I got the part. And
now, King Vidor later said that he thought actually that Gary Cooper was not the right choice for that movie, that he thought somebody like Humphrey Bogart would have been better in it. How did you feel about that, his casting in that movie?
Well, as you know, I mean, I loved him, so I like to think he was the best. But I don't think who you mentioned.
Bogart.
I don't think Bogart would have been good at all.
Mm.
It doesn't seem a part for Bogart. Mm-hmm. I love Humphrey Bogart. He was good, but I don't think that was his part.
Now, was your reaction to, you said you liked the look of Gary Cooper right away. When did you start to fall in love with him?
Well, I think immediately.
On location?
Yes, that's right. We went to
Arizona?
No.
Where?
It was in California, and it was in the mountains, you know, where he was.
Up in Arrowhead?
I'm not sure where it was, but anyway.
So you went off on location?
We went off on location, and I liked him. I really did, but...
He was a married man. We're not telling tales out of school here, because this is all part of public record now.
Everybody knows it.
Yes. So he was a married man, but you fell in love with a married man. Was that difficult for you?
Not very at that point in my life. It would be now. but it was... I adored doing the Fountainhead, and I mean, I loved, you know, to me it was a great thing, and I thought it was going to be an enormous hit, and it wasn't all that good, but I still love it.
It's a very popular film now, and very well regarded now. I think it's also fascinating that you started out in the Broadway theater in a play by Lillian Hellman, and made your big splash in the movies in a story by Ayn Rand, and those two ladies were great enemies throughout their life. So much so that a play has been written about it.
Oh yeah, it's very good. I liked it, and I saw that play twice, I think. Mm-hmm. Pretty good.
Did you get to know both those ladies?
Well, I knew Lillian Hellman very well because she directed it, and she directed me twice. She directed me in
The Children's Hour as well.
And then The Children's Hour when I came back from California. But and I did not know Ayn Rand all that well because she finally was brought in to write the screenplay. Mm-hmm. I think she was about the third person or the fourth person to have write it. And of course, she wanted nothing changed, not one iota. But I met her about 3-4 times when she came to watch us shoot. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really know her very well.
Now, you said you liked Gary Cooper right off the bat. When did he start reacting to you?
Well, I think he sensed it. Uh-huh. Because Gary was not, he was not totally loyal to his divine wife, Rocky. But he was always married to her. Always. We were together about 4 years.
When did that kind of get out around Hollywood that you two were seeing each other and that you were an item as well? Because that became public knowledge very quickly.
Yeah, I think it was about a year and a half or 2 years. I think about a year and a half afterwards. And I loved him. I will always love him. He was a beautiful man. And he loved me, but you know, it just didn't work because he was married to Rocky, and he loved Rocky. And Maria was his daughter, and I love Maria now. I see her. I saw her about 2 weeks ago. We had tea together. And she's a lovely girl. Even though she loathed me, looking back on it, you know. But when I had my stroke, she wrote me a letter, and it was a beautiful letter. And we finally became friends, but you know, not for some time.
But she was a young girl when you were kind of involved in her father's life, right?
I think she was about 11, I think, looking back.
Now, there's always been a rumor that you and Mrs. Cooper became friends later in life. Is that true?
Oh, well,
After Gary Cooper had died.
Yes.
And
she got married again, you know, after Gary died. She got married to a man operates on your face and that sort of thing. I know that... Well, forgot what I was going to say.
Whether or not you and she became friends later on.
Oh, yes, I know. When her second husband died, I wrote her a letter, and I sent it to Maria, and I said, if you think that Rocky should see this, give her this letter. Well, she gave it to her, and Rocky, apparently, she on her bed, she just read it over and over and over again. And then she wrote me a letter, and she tore it up because it wasn't what she... And then she wrote me another letter, and we became friends. But not, we didn't see each other always, but we saw each other, about 3 or 4 times until she died.
Kind of a wonderful end to that story. I think.
Like it.
Yes, indeed.
So good. It's what, you know, what life's made of.
Now, did your relationship with Gary Cooper, did that in any way, like, make it difficult for you in Hollywood or around Warner Brothers? Being seen as the other woman in this relationship with one of the kings of Hollywood who was...
Well, it might have had something to do with it, but I was really not the great success that they hoped I would be. Many years when I went back on the stage and I did about 3 or 4 plays, and by the way, I'm going to get a great award.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. Where was I?
Well, we were just talking about how it affected you at Warner Brothers.
Oh, yes.
Perhaps,
okay.
Or the reactions to you.
Well, they dropped me. Warner Brothers.
Okay, but before we get there, I want to get to some of the other things you did at Warner's, because they're really wonderful now to look back on, such as The Hasty Heart with Ronald Reagan,
yes.
The second film you did with Ronald Reagan that you did in England.
Yes.
Terrific movie. Wonderful.
He was a lovely man. I liked him very much. And then I did...
The Breaking Point with John Garfield.
Yes, yes.
One of the great films.
I loved, I thought it was a good film, too. Really.
And what was Garfield like to work with?
Well, he was my favorite. Not
not your favorite?
No, he wasn't, because he was... I mean, he was always telling me what to do, and I don't know. No, it's just I wanted to touch him, and he would go, eh. And he was not my favorite, but you know, he was good.
Now, that's based on a story by Hemingway, To Have and Have Not.
Yes.
The Breaking Point. And did you get to know Hemingway?
Yes, I did get to know Hemingway, I know that he thinks that's the best film ever made from any of his books.
I'd have to go along with that. I think it's great. But he was also a great friend of Cooper's, right?
Oh, yes. Gary took me to meet him and where he was. And his dear wife. And she didn't like me because she didn't want to see Rocky be replaced. But then... I saw her years later, and she was so great to me because she was very happy of what had happened, you know, and she was really good. And I'd had my stroke then, and that's, I think, what based on.
You also did another film with Gary Cooper, Bright Leaf.
Yes, I did.
And what about that? Did you like that relationship, that movie?
I wanted so badly to play the part that Lauren Bacall played. I could have killed. And Gary didn't fight for me, and that really depressed me very much. So I did the other part. But I've seen it now, and I think my part comes off better. I liked it.
It would have been better, though, I think, with the two ladies changing parts in that movie, actually.
Well, I wanted so badly to play that part, but, you know, they wouldn't have me.
So now you're in Hollywood, you're at Warner Brothers, you're involved with very much in love with a married man who's married to one of the great social leaders of Hollywood and all of that. And eventually Warner Brothers comes to the conclusion that your career isn't quite panning out for them the
That's
way they
right.
want it. So you...
They dropped me, shall we
they
say.
They dropped you. Yeah. But you immediately were signed by 20th Century Fox for some films, including a film that is now one of the great classic films of all time, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, I love The Day the Earth Stood Still. I thought it was hysterical when I couldn't keep a straight face. And Michael Rennie, who I knew very well, I mean, you know, he was a good friend of Katie Stevens and Hugh Wilder. And I really knew him, and he said, I would giggle, and he would say, excuse me, do you intend to laugh? Is that and I would say, no, I don't laugh. But to me, I thought it was the most hysterical thing I'd ever done in my life. But now, I think it's gorgeous. I've seen it about 3 or 4 times recently, and it's really good. And I could kill myself for almost laughing.
Well, in those days, in 1951, major studios just didn't make sci-fi films, and they weren't highly regarded at that time. you know. I think that was one of the first that came out that was really a well-regarded sci-fi film.
Yes, I think it was. And I'm so proud to be in it now, because it's really good.
Also, you have dark hair in that. You were very blonde in Breaking Point and Fountainhead and all that. Where was the decision made to change the color of your hair?
Well, I tell you, Betsy Drake Grant. You know, remember Betsy Drake?
Married to Cary Grant,
yeah,
yes.
She's still with us, lives in England. And she's the one who said, I think you should put your hair back its proper color. And I said, okay, Betsy. So I did, and they said they'd drop me if I didn't. And I said, well, drop. That was what happened with Warner Brothers. And then so I had it.
So Warners didn't want you to be a brunette.
No, they didn't. But so then I did, I think, what was the first one I did? Was
Operation Pacific, I believe, was your first with dark hair at Warner Brothers.
Oh, was
with
it?
With John Wayne.
Okay. But then I think I did. Did I go with Warner with 20th Century Fox first?
After that.
And I did the thing with what's his name?
Tyrone Power?
No. I'm talking about the director who I did.
Robert Wise.
Yes. Robert Wise. He was gorgeous.
But you'd worked with Robert Wise at Warner Brothers with Three Secrets.
Yes, I'd done Three Secrets, and then he wanted me to do The Day the Earth Stood Still, and then he put me in one with what's his name? I'm so bad with names.
Victor Mature?
You are so great.
Something for the Birds,
I wish I were like you. You know names backwards, and I having had a stroke, I can't remember them. But we had a lovely time.
What was Robert Wise as a director?
He was very good. And, you know, he was a cutter to begin with. He cut fabulous. What was the famous?
Citizen Kane.
Yes. He was the cutter for that. But he was a very good director, and he directed what's the most famous one?
Sound of Music and West Side Story, both, yeah.
He's just very...
But the wonderful thing about Robert Wise is the fact that he was so versatile.
Yes.
I mean, he did things like Three Secrets and West Side Story, a musical, and Sound of Music, and then The Haunting, which is a great film, and I Want to Live with Susan Hayward. I mean, he did a lot of varied things, which was so great about him.
He was very good. I liked him, and three films he cast me in.
So now you're a 20th Century Fox. You do that. You went to Universal and did Weekend with Father with Van Heflin.
Yeah.
You went to MGM and did
Washington. I love Van Heflin.
Did you?
He was a divine man.
And why particularly did you like him?
Oh, he was just so gay and good fun, and I just adored him, you know.
Wonderful actor.
Yes, he was. He was a real beauty.
You went to MGM and did Washington Story with Van Johnson.
Uh-huh.
And
what else did I do then? Do you remember?
No, I think that was it at MGM.
I thought there were two.
Well, a little later, Subject was Roses, but we'll get to that in a
minute. I'm wrong. You're right.
But but anyway, so the career wasn't really panning out in California.
No.
At this point, you'd broken up with Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
So things were kind of not so great for you. But by the way, I do want to mention one thing that I think is interesting about you, is that way back in your New York days, one of your roommates for a while and a great, great friend of yours was Jean Hagen.
Jean Hagen.
Who we love here at TCM because of Singing in the Rain.
She went to Warner, she went to Northwestern, as did I, but she was above me in grades. I didn't really know her well. I knew Helen Horton, we did Shakespearean thing, I can't forget the name of it. But I didn't know Jean well. And Jean, she's the one who...
At school, you didn't know her well.
No,
but you
not
got to
well,
know her very well
not
after.
Well. But I know that Helen, she told me that Jean was coming and she didn't have a place to stay. And I said, have her move in with me. I had a bed about this big and in a single room of the black with a looking on bricks. And a bathroom down the hall. And so she came, and we lived together, I don't know, about 3 weeks, and then we decided to move into a bigger one, which was two blocks up, and then we Then we decided to move to the West Side. She was going with Tom Seidel, who she later married. And
did you know Charlton Heston at Northwestern?
I did not know him at Northwestern because he was in the war. Mm. His wife, though, she was at Northwestern, and she did nothing but talk about him. And she got letters from him about 10 a week or something. And she adored him, and she still does, I'm sure.
Lydia.
Yes, Lydia.
So, okay, now it's not working out in California. The Gary Cooper affair is over and all of that, and that's very tough on you. So you decide to go back to New York, to leave Hollywood.
I did.
Because it wasn't working in Hollywood anymore for you.
No, it wasn't.
But right off the bat, you had wonderful success there again, doing a revival of?
The Children's Hour.
With Kim Hunter.
Yes, and it was fantastic because I was living in poverty, I mean, just about. And because I hadn't saved money, I never am good at saving money. And I know that I read that Kermit Bloomgarden, that he was going to do the Children's Hour. And I called him, he's the one that produced Another Part of the Forest. And I said, Kermit, could I read for the Children's Hour? And he said, yeah, if you want to. And I read, and I got it at one. I could choose between the parts, so I chose Martha, and then Kim
Hunter
was in. I loved her. She was really a delicious woman, and her husband, he was divine too. But she is no longer.
No, we know her so well though from A Streetcar Named Desire. That performance in that movie.
Yeah, she was gorgeous.
Yeah. So that was a great, great return to New York for you.
Oh, yes.
And then you did other plays like A Room Full of Roses and all of that. But it was several years before you made another film.
Yes.
Did you miss the movies at that point?
No, I didn't miss them at all. But I think it was Breakfast at Tiffany. No.
Go back to A Face in the Crowd.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. You're so knowledgeable, and I am not. I did do A Face in the Crowd with Elia Kazan being the director because I'd done a scene from the Actors Studio. I love the Actors Studio, and Elia Kazan heard about it, how beautiful it was. It was Romeo and Juliet, which I loved. And then I did one from Cat on the Hot Tin Roof or something. And he put me in, is it Cat on the Hot? Yeah,
yes.
He put me in it when Barbara Bel Geddes was on holiday. And,
so you were back on Broadway then in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof for Kazan.
Yeah, for about 3 weeks of her holiday. And he cast me in...
A Face in the Crowd.
Face in the Crowd.
Now
and
that
I
again...
I loved doing it. I loved it.
Great film.
Oh, it was so beautiful. And all the people in it, named them.
Andy Griffith
Andy
is here's first film.
Griffith. I loved
Walter
him.
Matthau's in it.
What a beautiful.
First film for Lee Remick and Tony Franciosa.
And Lee Remick, I love.
Yeah.
You know, I love them all.
Yeah. That's another one of the films that now was not maybe as appreciated in its time as it is now. It's considered such a classic film
it's
now.
It's a good film.
And powerful film.
Yeah.
So that kind of puts you back in the movie business, even though it was shot, I believe, in New York, not in Hollywood, wasn't it?
No, it was. We started first in Tennessee, in what are the other states? You know, about three states.
Uh-huh.
When he was just a Andrew Griffith was just a rotten man, and I met him in jail, and then I think we went to, I don't know, we finally came back to New York, and that's when it was really shot.
Now, in the meantime, you also got married again. You fell in love and got married to to a famous man.
I met Roald Dahl at Lillian.
Great writer.
Yes, at Lillian Hellman's house. Lillian, she had I'd just gotten the part in the Children's Hour. and she was having a party, and she invited me, and I went, and I had on a short dress, and there was a fabulous formal party, and I said, "Oh, let me go home," and she said, "Nasty," and so I stayed, and there I saw Roald Dahl, and I said, "Who is he? I liked his look." And she shouted Roald Dahl at the top of her voice, and I said, "Shh." And then I sat next to him at the supper table, and Leonard Bernstein was across from him. And he did nothing but talk to Leonard Bernstein, not a sentence for me, not a question or anything. And I kept trying to get into the act, and he'd say, "Eh." But then I know he called me up about 2 days later and asked me out. Well, I did not want to go because he did not. I thought he was beautiful when I saw him, but I didn't like his behavior to me. And so I said, "Oh, so sorry, can't go." And then he called me up for another date. Well, I couldn't think of an excuse, so I said, "Okay, I'll go." And things went on, and we eventually got married in about, I think about nine months later.
So, okay, now we're into the late 50s, and in 1961, you do Breakfast at Tiffany's. And talk about that. That's another film that's such a great classic today.
Well, I hadn't done one for years, and Judy...
Balaban.
Yes. She, not she, it was the...
No, no, Judy Shepherd.
Judy Shepherd. She's the one that...
The wife of Richard Shepherd.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She's the one that suggested me. And I got an offer, and I signed, and that was very good. And Judy, she was so beautiful to me when I was there, and I know that sorry, I'm bringing the subject up, but I know that the surgeon who operated on me when I had my terrible stroke was the brother-in-law of her husband.
Ah.
And I saw a lot of him.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, was that a pleasant experience, Breakfast at Tiffany's, making that?
Oh, yes, I liked it. I liked it quite a lot. And I liked her, and I love the director. He was beautiful, and his name was?
Blake Edwards.
Blake Edwards. Now, I shouldn't say this, but I say it every time I get a chance. I say that the leading man who was...
George Peppard.
I'd been at the Actors Studio with him, and we'd done a scene together. We'd done... I forget what scene, but we got along superbly. I thought he was sensational, and he was ha-ha-ha, making jokes. And I was so thrilled to be doing this film with him. Well, my darling, he had changed. He was a horror. He really was a horror. I wanted to, I dominated him so much in it, and he did not like that. He did not like me to dominate him. And he and Blake Edwards, they almost had a fist fight because I made the mistake of saying, "Oh, don't, please don't fight." And Blake gave in. I don't know why. But I loathed him at the end of it. I really loathed him. He's one of the few people I loathe. There are about two or three.
You'll tell us, I hope.
No.
You didn't work much with Audrey Hepburn, but did you get to know her well during the making of the film?
Yes, I got to know her slightly. Uh-huh. And she was a lovely woman. Uh-huh. Lovely woman.
Okay, right around 1961, that film came out. That was a bad year in many ways for you. That's the year Gary Cooper died. Mm-hmm. And I know you still had strong feelings about him.
Yes.
And it's also the year that a terrible accident occurred that kind of started this Greek tragedy portion of your life, which...
That's
you know,
right.
It's so much a part of your life. I know it's not something you ever like to concentrate on, nor do you, but it's a fact of your life, is that the first thing that happened was...
My son. I had two daughters, and then I had a beautiful son. He was fantastic. And he was born July the 30th, and this was December the 5th, 6th, 7th. I don't know. And I just done what?
Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Yes. I'd just done Breakfast at Tiffany. And I'd come back, and I was in the, the nurse to get him, and she, to get Tessa from nursery school, and she was on her way back.
In New York City?
In New York City. On about, I don't know, 83rd or 84th. And I was at the A&P. I was doing shopping. When all of a sudden I heard a siren go by, and I thought, what is it? And I it was a police car. And I thought, oh, thank God. And then when I got to the corner of my daily woman, that's what we call them in England, she was looking for me, and she said, I'm sorry to tell you, but your son was hit by a taxi. I dropped all the groceries, and I ran up to Ruel, who was working in Clifford Odette's apartment. That's where he worked. And Ruel, he laid down the pencils and paper, and he, we went downstairs, and we went to the hospital, and the doctor said, he will die. And Tessa was crying, the nurse was crying, and I was at the hospital, and Ruel was too, from then on out. I was doing needlework, and Ruel, he went in the Theo was in a ward, you know, with all the people who were seriously ill. And Ruel, he came back, and he said, the nurse, his nurse, she was giving him really too much medicine, I thought. And when we was, as he said that, the doctor ran to the room, and he made my son throw up, because it would have killed him, this medicine she gave him. I think she began to be suspicious, and she called the doctor, and he ran. And then Ruel and I decided we would change the hospital. And we put him way uptown to the Presbyterian Hospital.
Columbia Presbyterian.
Yeah. And then he was there, and then we brought him home. And the doctor, he came and Ruel didn't like the way he seemed. So, and I had flu, it was so much happened then. And the doctor took Theo back to the hospital, and he was blind, he had hydrocephalus. It was just really terrible, you know, and I was in the hospital all the time, and he had this shunt put in his head. And I think he had, I don't know, maybe one operation here. And then in England, he had three or four operations. See, the shunt would block up. And
he'd been in a baby carriage.
Yes.
And
yes.
Been hit by a taxi cab.
Yes.
So then you the family moved to England, right?
Yes. We didn't intend to stay there always, but we sublet our apartment, and then.
Then in England, another tragedy happened.
Yes. My darling Olivia, my eldest daughter, measles was in the school. And we could give Theo the injection, so he could not get measles. I tried to get it for Olivia and Tessa. But I know that Ruel's brother-in-law was a doctor, a very well looked after man, and he said, let them have it, it'll be good for them. And I just couldn't get it for my daughters. And Olivia, I went upstairs and found her, and I knew she was dying. And I went and rang Ruel. We only had to do it with a light then in those days. And Ruel's sister was there, and an ambulance finally came, and I knew that she was dying. And I said to the nurses, they were so frightened, and I said, they said, she's gonna be all right. And I said, no, she will die. And she did that night. And Ruel, he was, you never say, I really held us together, because he was the most distraught man you will ever see in your life. He could not believe that his daughter dead, but she did. And we had great funeral, but you know, and then I wanted another baby so badly, and it took me about 2 years to have Ophelia.
But there was, in this tragedy that happened, after that, there was a high point work-wise it came, because right after that,
yes,
after the death
right.
of your daughter,
you're right.
the tragic accident, came HUD. And how did HUD come about? That was in 63.
Well, I'd gone to California to do a television thing, you know. And Marty Ritt, who I loved, and I knew from New York, he sent me this script. And I called him, and then I went back. I went to their house for lunch on Saturday, and he said, I said, I love this script, but I said, I really can't do it because Olivia's dead and I've got to be home a lot, you know. And he said, you can be home, I'll get rid of you and then I'll do the rest and then you come to California and do what's there and that'll be it. And he was a divine man and it happened that way.
So he set up the shooting schedule.
Yes.
So you'd work a section, then you'd go back to England,
yes.
then you'd come back and do another section.
Isn't that good?
It's fabulous.
He was a fabulous man.
And that's a great film.
I love it.
A great film.
And I did win an Oscar for it.
You did win an Oscar for it. Did that surprise you? Because you won in
yeah.
the Best Actress category, and
yeah.
that's kind of a
it's
small
just
part.
Tiny part. Tiny part. But I want to tell you that, I was not there because I had a baby in about 3 days' time. My daughter, Ophelia, and Annabella Powers, she's the one who...
Tyrone Powers' wife,
yeah,
ex-wife.
She's the one who... accepted it for me.
How is Paul Newman to work with?
I love Paul. He's really a fantastic man. I really love him. And I think Paul and I and one of the writers are the only ones living now. Everybody else is dead.
Yes, Brandon DeWilde is gone.
He's
Melvin
dead.
Melvin Douglas. Yes, Martin Ritt.
And the photographer, he's dead.
James Wong Howe.
James Wong Howe. And one of the writers is dead, and everybody.
Had you known Paul Newman before this?
Oh, yes, I'd been at the Actors Studio with mm-hmm. him. And he was, when I first went back, we didn't even have a building then, we just a rented room. I was there, and Paul, he was about two or three seats away from me, and I was back of him, and I thought, what a beauty. That's all I did was look at him. He was so gorgeous. I loved him. But he wasn't the big man that he became then. But mm-hmm. he was lovely. I really like him.
Okay, so now part of this Greek tragedy that seemed to be following you for a while, you've gone through this horrible thing with your son and with your daughter.
Yes.
And then you had a great high with HUD and winning the Academy Award. You did In Harm's Way with John Wayne, Kirk Douglas for...
Love doing it.
For Otto Preminger. Now, he's not a director most people love.
He had his faults.
He was a tough guy, right?
Oh, boy. And I tell you, the stars, we were perfect. We were perfect. We were perfection. But the little ones, you've never seen anybody be so bad to them. Oh, he's terrible. He was.
To the people that couldn't fight back.
Yeah, but I love how he was treating me, and I'm sorry he treated the other people. But he was, he's no longer with us.
And that's a very important film, In Harm's Way, at
yes.
that time.
Yeah.
Now, also, after that, then you were signed by the great John Ford
yes.
to do a movie called Seven Women.
Yes.
And you started.
I love John Ford. He was really fantastic.
What about him did you like?
Oh, he was tough, and you know, had a patch on his eye, and he had tea. We all had tea, and we had to listen to him talk because he was the hero. He was it. I loved him. Oh, he was gorgeous.
Having tea doesn't sound like a very tough guy.
Oh yes, but tea. We had it every day.
Now you were working 3 days on that movie, and then
it was 3 days.
Yeah,
I guess
and then
it was.
You know, Then the ceiling really fell on you.
Yeah.
Then the Greek tragedy really started.
That is right.
So tell us what happened.
Well, we were living in Marty Ritt's house because Marty Ritt, he was doing a film in Ireland. And he rented his house to us, which was so good of him. And
you were pregnant, by the way, at this
but
point.
But nobody
right?
knew it
nobody
except
knew it,
Ruel
but you were pregnant.
And me. I thought, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. And then I came home from work. And I was giving Tessa her bath when Ruel, he was coming up with a drink for me, and he took one look and he knew that I was having a stroke. He's very bright in that way. And I vomited and I lay down on the bed, and Ruel, he called exactly the right doctor, Dr. Charles Carton, who we'd talked to because of Theo's terribleness, and he had met him, and he called him and he said, this is serious, and Dr. Carton, he said, shut up to his children, and they shut up, and he said that I was having a stroke. Well, he could not believe it was me. He said, you mean Theo, you mean, no, and he finally, and he said, all right, I will send an ambulance to Marty's house, and the ambulance found it so difficult to find it. Finally, the date of one of my nurses, they went out and they found him. And he, and I was taken to the hospital with the ambulance, and he examined me, and he said, he said to Royal, he said, well, I don't think we'll do anything, not tonight, we'll see her tomorrow. And then Royal went in, and he saw me having another, I don't know what they're like, seizures, I don't know what they're like. But, he went out and told him, and then he took me to the x-ray place. And that's when I had the horror of it. And I was thoroughly paralyzed. I mean, I cannot see you now until I look at you because this eye doesn't
work. So this
work.
Was like three strokes that you were having?
Yeah, I had three massive strokes in one night.
Do you remember any of that?
No, not have not the vaguest idea what they were. I don't have any memory of that whole day, and a long time afterwards.
You were in a coma for quite a while too,
yes,
weren't you?
Yes, I was in a coma for 21 days, and I was not expected to live. And I woke up, and my arm was like that. I was terrible.
And pregnant.
Even though nobody knew it but Ruel and me, but they soon did. Ruel told Dr. Carton that I was pregnant. But I was not expected to live, but I did, which was fantastic.
You certainly did.
Here I am with all my joy.
You were 39 years old when that happened.
That's right.
That I think may come as a surprise to a lot of people, because one tends to think that strokes happen to people at an older age.
No, mostly they do. But some people have it young. Some people have it even younger than I was.
Yeah, 39, that's incredible.
Yeah.
What got you through that? I mean, you had to have a great will to live to be able to get through something like that.
Well, I am a stubborn woman. I think that's what did it, my stubbornness. Because I didn't want to live. I really did not want to live. It was so terrible to be always a terrible thing, and you couldn't talk, you couldn't make sense, and it was just terrible. And you know, and I know Betsy Drake. She came to see me, and she tried to make me talk, and she, you know, but it was just awful. But I didn't realize. I was very apparently in the hospital. Jean Alexander, she was my nurse in the hospital, and she tells me that when she'd brush my teeth, and I'd just reach out her arm, and I was so gay and such fun and so good in the hospital, even though I couldn't speak. And there was a woman in the ward with me, and she made fun of me, and she would say, and I would shoot dirty looks at her because I couldn't say a word. And but it was, you know, just, I think I was in the hospital for about, 3 weeks or 4 weeks anyway. And must have been 4 or 5 weeks because I was unconscious 21 days.
But then the recovery began. Now, was your husband supportive about all of this?
Oh, yes. Now, he really was a fabulous man. He really was. I mean, he was there twice a day, 3 times a day, even though I was unconscious. He knew what he, you know, and Dr. Carton told him that I would be an idiot, really, because, yeah, but I ain't that way. I don't quite know why, but he was very depressed about what he saw. But
well, the incredible thing about you is not only having gone through all of this, not just for yourself, but with your kids and everything, you have such a joy of living, and you're so out there all the time. I mean, you go out in New York all the time, you go on cruises, you go visit hospitals, you have a great joy of being around people and doing things.
You remind me, there's a hospital,
yes,
which is called the Patricia Neal Rehabilitation Hospital in Knoxville, Tennessee.
I know, that's
and
great.
And it's a great hospital. And I'm so flattered that they named it for me.
Well, I think it's just an incredible story about survival and the desire and the will to live and doing all of that. And it's certainly, you're not just existing, you've got that twinkle in your eye, and you just love doing things and going out. Now, you also are one of the few people that have had your story told on the screen. I mean, the Patricia Neal story was done on television with no less than 2-time Academy Award winner Glenda Jackson playing you.
I love her. She's really great.
And did you like the story told, the way it was told
on
the screen?
Yes. No, I didn't want her to play me. I wanted to play the one I'm trying to think of her name. I wanted her to play me, and I can't think of her name, but she's great. And but they cast Glenda Jackson. And I was horrified. But then I saw it, and I thought she was sensational. I loved her, and I loved Ruel's man, whose name was, you know?
The actor that played?
Yes.
No, I don't know.
Blake.
Was that not Dirk Bogarde?
Yeah, Dirk Bogarde.
Dirk Bogarde.
Dead right, you guess well.
Okay. Now, also that same year, your autobiography came out, which is called As I Am, which has just been republished, as a matter of fact, and is out, so anybody who wants to read this incredible story can do so. Was that difficult to write, to go back over all that history again?
No, I desperately wanted to. I mean, you see, all I could think about was my life. And it is a very good book. It really is.
Even though I
wrote, it was my story, you know. I did have help writing it, though. I did. Mother Dolores Hart. Dick Danute.
Yes. Now, the same year, you also did a big, massive television production of All Quiet on the Western Front, and also a movie, The Ghost Story, with Fred Astaire and Melvin Douglas, and a great cast, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. But you didn't want to do that, you said.
No, I was trying to call from England to turn it down, and the phone was busy, busy, busy. And my daughter Ophelia, she came into the room, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm waiting for the phone to, they won't be busy, so I can turn this film down." And she said, "No, you're going to do it." I said, "Okay, Mom," because I was having trouble with my marriage, and she wanted me to get out of there, which I did, and it was just a tiny part. I mean, it's just so tiny, I can't imagine them casting me in it. But I had a good time. Warren Langton, he came and he helped me with it, and he was my great driver. And we, all the antique stores, because I bought a house in Martha's Vineyard. It was a great house, and it was owned by the captain of the ship of the man who wrote Moby Dick. Warren, he drove me around, and we bought things in antique stores, and so I like doing it, really, in the end.
And you still have the house?
I still have that house. And I've done a lot to it, really. I mean, you know, the floor had to be changed because you could look and see the basement.
Now, to go back a little bit, we should also point out that Seven Women, the film you were working on when you had your Strokes, was finally done with Anne Bancroft stepping in for
you. Yes, I love Anne Bancroft. She is the great girl. We were in a play together called, what was it called? Helen Keller's, you know.
Miracle Worker.
Miracle Worker.
Yes. You did Miracle Worker on Broadway.
Yes, I did it. I opened in it.
Playing the mother.
Yes, I was the mother. And unfortunately, I got pregnant that night.
That night.
With my...
little celebrating going on there.
And so that was good.
They also wanted you to do the film, but you couldn't do that.
No,
that
I did not. Was not offered it.
Really?
No.
Oh, I had always heard you had been.
Oh, it hurt me, but...
oh, big mistake.
Well, you know, but I mean, I loved Anne. And it was beautiful.
Now, one film you did do, which was a great, great success, and you're absolutely wonderful in it, is The Subject Was Roses.
I love doing
for which you received an Academy Award nomination.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little about The Subject Was Roses.
Well, I really didn't want to do it. I mean,
this was after the stroke.
Yes, and a stroke, terrible thing to have happen. It really is. I'm not suggesting that anybody have it. It's terrible. But anyway, my husband, he wanted me to go to work. And I know that they wanted me to do that play.
Mm-hmm.
But my son had been damaged, and you know, I really could not do it. And then when the film was doing it, they wanted me to do the film, and they all came over, the director, the producer, the writer, they all
to England,
came, yes,
where you were living,
to
there.
Have a look at me, and they decided that I should do it, and they offered it to me, and Ruel wanted me to do it, so he's the one that shoved me into it. And I didn't like it, you know, the beginning. But about the third day, I began to be a little interested. And at the end of that film, I was the happiest woman alive. I loved
that. That must have been nerve-wracking, though, going back to work for the first time with the burden of having had the stroke.
Oh, yes, it really was. But I just didn't want to do it. But I'm so happy that I did.
Did you have trouble at the beginning remembering your lines or anything like that?
Oh, trouble. Trouble, you have no idea. I mean, it takes so much out of you to have a stroke, because I used to have fabulous memory. I knew everybody's part and everything, you know. But that when you have a stroke, it is very difficult to learn lines.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could learn them now if I really try. But you know, it's a terrible thing to have happen.
Now, it sounds like your husband really kept like pushing you.
Yes, he did.
Like all of that. So is that good therapy? Was that a good,
yes, because
you'd recommend
he wanted,
to others?
Yes, because he wanted me to work.
Uh-huh.
He thought I was good and he wanted me to use it. And I'm very happy I did. I mean, I'm an actress, pure and simple, and I love to act. And anybody got a job, let me have a look at it, because I love it.
Well, you're just one of the best.
Well,
you should be working all the time.
I'll spread that rumor.
Now, you did divorce your husband in 1983.
Yes, I did not want to. He had. A lot of ladies, but one got him. But I did not want a divorce, because I think when you're married forever. But he didn't. I now thought so. I didn't think so in my day, but I did. I wanted it to work, and he wanted it to in the end. But in the end, he succumbed.
Did you stay friends?
Well, not in the beginning. Oh, boy, boy, boy. You want to see an idiot, you know. You just have to know me. I could have killed. I could have killed everybody, and it was terrible. But in the end, then I thought it was his last year. And it was my son's 30th birthday, and I did want to go. It was all over it then. So I wrote them a letter and I said, time for me to come to. And I said, I would love to come to Theo's birthday party. And they wrote me a hysterical letter. They'd love to have me. And I went, and it was good. I saw him about 3 or 4 times, and he embraced me. And it was, you know, so it was things were...
You've been through a lot together.
Oh, boy, we had.
Now, you also did a wonderful film more recently, Cookie's Fortune, for Robert Altman. Great
yeah.
film.
I'm happy he offered me that part, and I love doing it. I was the first shot.
They got
rid
that
of
mean?
Me quick.
Oh.
Yeah, I think I was there about 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
Finished.
And what's Altman like to work with as a director?
Oh, he's lovely, lovely. He's a good man.
Uh-huh.
And I met him years ago when I was in Honolulu, because he had come over to discuss with Roald Dahl the film that he wanted him to write. And so Roald wrote it, and it's a long story. I won't even go into it.
Now, did you, you didn't work with, who did you work with in Cookie's Fortune? I mean, it has a wonderful cast. Glenn Close and Julianne Moore, Chris
yeah.
O'Donnell,
they
Liv
good?
Tyler. They're all wonderful, yeah.
I love them, but I there were some I didn't meet because, as I said, he got rid of me fast.
Uh-huh.
But the writer, she was a divine woman. I liked her, and the photographer, he was good.
Let's talk about your most recent honor, the Theater Hall of Fame. In New York City, inducted into the Theater Hall of Fame. Great honor.
Is that not gorgeous?
Yes.
I'm so happy that they have decided to let me in.
Along with Vanessa Redgrave
yeah.
this year, and Kevin Kline, mm-hmm. The costume designer Jane Greenwood, a lot of great people. I think there are nine of you all together, actually.
Is that not lovely?
Yes.
I'm so thrilled. It'll be the end of January, I think, January 26th or something.
So does it mean a lot to you? I mean, you were the first person to win a Tony Award. You've got an Academy Award and everything. Do awards still mean anything?
Oh, I love them. Oh, yes. So you can get me another one. I'd love to get another Academy Award. That would be good.
Well,
but I doubt it because I was up and I didn't get it. Just one. But, you know, if you see one going, let me know.
Bring us up to date on your kids, your children.
Oh, okay. Well,
and you have a granddaughter that's a very successful model.
I
but
do.
But bring us up to date on your
Her
kids.
Name is Sophie Dahl, and she's elegant, and she's a lovely model. Let's see, there's Ophelia. No, there's, start at the front, there's Tessa, there's Theo, there's Ophelia, and there's Lucy. And they were all born in England. They're all in America now. It's fantastic. But, I want to tell you what we did last summer. We did Valerie Eaton Griffith, who was a fabulous teacher, the one who taught me. She was really sensational. She didn't know she could, I mean. But she was a great teacher, and she had me every day of the week, and from morning to night, and then they had tea. It was really beautiful.
And where was this?
It's in England.
In England.
In Great Missenden,
okay.
Buckingham. She had never taught, but, you know, she'd had an illness, and but now
so this was teaching you after your stroke?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I mean, I couldn't have done without her. She's the best person in the world. I'm sorry I haven't discussed her, but she really was gorgeous. And she's the one who did the thing in the church in Great Missenden. And she's the one about Roald Dahl. And we started with, you know, Roald's life. And then there were three of my children, and there were five or six grandchildren. And we all read things from Roald's book, and it was superb. It really went beautifully, and it was in the great church in the hill. Oh, it was beautiful. Wish you'd been there.
Yes, indeed. Mm. Now, there's a remake, I believe, in the works of what is known to most people as Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
I'm told. But
Charlie and the... I think it's under its original title of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
That's good.
It's being remade, one of his famous books.
Yes.
Very esteemed writer, for those that don't know him.
I like them all. He was really a fabulous short story writer
mm-hmm.
and a fabulous children's writer.
Mm-hmm.
He really was, well, he was the best until The Darling Woman came along.
Harry Potter's mother.
But he's still a fabulous writer. a watch.
Now, any of your kids going into the theater or writing?
No, I wanted Tessa to, and I got her a, well, I was the one that suggested her to a thing that we did in Nova Scotia. And she, ooh, she would play a
about
fabulous
writing?
Part.
No,
or
it acting?
Was, no, it was Darren McGavin's. He directed it.
Oh, but a play, to be in a play.
No, it was a film.
A film, okay.
And I remember I got to test the part because I lived in England, but I was in America, and I was speaking to the director's wife, and I said, you know, I'm looking forward to doing this film in Nova Scotia. And she said, we have everyone except your daughter in it. And I said, uh-oh, a great idea just occurred to me. My own daughter. What a good idea, she said. I will call him at once, the director. And she called him. He was in Nova Scotia. And he caught the next plane to England. And I called Ruel and I said, well, he's going to come over. And he's going to look at, because Tessa was home. She was in boarding school, but she was home that weekend. And he said, oh, Pat. He didn't want her to go to work. And I said, let me speak to her. And I said, this man is going to come to look at you. And she said, I want to do it. And he came. And he wanted her, so he cast her. And she came over and, well, anyway, she didn't become an actress, but she was very good in that film. She's better than me.
So are they all live in various places in the United States?
Ophelia, Lucy, she lives in California. Uh-huh. Ophelia lives in Boston. Theo, he lives in Florida, and Tessa, she's in, I forget, I have to go, but I forget where it is.
But you stay in close tabs with them and see them often?
Oh, yes, oh, yeah. I love them all, and we get on beautifully.
One thing I want to talk about is your distinctive voice. You have a voice unlike anybody else. Where did that voice come from?
I am lucky. I want to tell you that my mother has a high voice. I had one. She died this year. My sister has a high voice, I mean, but I have a deep voice. And I'm going to tell you what happened when I was young. I have a sister 2 years older than me, and I had a cousin 4 years older than me. And he and she, they were teasing a girl across the street. And I don't know if she was about 10, I guess, or something. And they would make fun, and then they would run. And I was with them.
And this is when you were a little too?
Yeah, I was about three or four. Uh-huh. And I would try to keep up with them. And I couldn't. And in the end, she got a hold of me, and she said, I'll just choke you, Miss Lady, which she did. And I screamed and screamed, and my mother finally heard and came and saved my life. And that's what I've been told is why I have a deep voice.
Oh, so you can be very grateful to that little girl.
I'm very grateful.
Absolutely.
I don't know what's true, but it was told that.
Now, you know, you can see yourself on the screen. You see what a great-looking woman you are. How do you
what
feel about your looks? Because obviously that's been a great help to you in your career, attracting everybody from Richard Rodgers early on to Gary Cooper and a lot of other people, and still attracts us. How do you feel about your looks?
Well, it's all right. I'm not ugly. I'm not ugly. I'm not the beauty of Elizabeth Taylor and that sort of people. But I look okay. I'm all right.
Did you like yourself on the screen when you first saw yourself for the first time?
Oh, God, no. I thought it was terrible because that was John Loves Mary, and my hair was terrible, my makeup was terrible, and I didn't know what to do. I was very bad in that film, but The Fountainhead was a lot better because I had the greatest hairdresser, the greatest makeup, the greatest designer, and I looked good in that one.
Very glamorous role.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I want to go back to and ask you about when you first knew that you were in love with Gary Cooper? Was there a particular point at which, when you were making that film, that you knew you were in love with him? There's some very steamy scenes when the two of you meet in that movie.
It's just that I loved him. I thought he was the most ravishingly beautiful man I had ever seen in my life, and I still think so. I think he is was superb, superb. And he was great fun. He had a great sense of humor. He was bright, you know, and even though people say, oh, not at all bright, but he was. He was very brilliant, and even though he knew when to, well, I don't describe it very well, but he was, I just adored him. To me, he was the beauty of the world, and that was it, you know, and it was true for about, oh, 4.5 years, I think. But I'll never get over him. I still love him. And I loved Roald Dahl, too, who came after him. But those two, I guess I love.
When you were doing the quarry scene in The Fountainhead, were you already in love with Gary Cooper?
Well, no, because that was the first scene.
First scene you shot?
Sure, that was the first scene. And, but, you know, I was so frightened. And to walk on that great thing with those trousers on, and I was just that much from the great rock, and I was so frightened of falling, but I don't think that scene is particularly good, but you may be like it.
It's steamy.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you were reunited and did Bright Leaf, that film did not do terribly well, even with the great cast. Gary Cooper, Lauren Bacall, Patricia Neal, Jack Carson, Donald Crisp, wonderful cast. Why do you think that film didn't do better?
Well, if I'd been cast again, and if I could play her part, it would be beautiful.
You think the casting had something to do with it?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I think it's a good film. I saw it recently.
Yes, I think it is too.
Yeah, I like it.
But the public didn't quite go for it at that time.
I don't quite know why.
When is the last time you saw Gary Cooper?
I think I saw him for the last time in England. He was doing a film at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and I'd gone in for some reason to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. I forget why it was, but and I was told he was there, so I thought I'll go and see him. So I went, and
this was long after the breakup.
Oh
right?
Yeah, oh, a long time. And it was what's the name of the dear man who was in it? He's Northwestern man.
Charlton Heston. Wreck of the Mary Dear.
That's right. That's what they were shooting, and I know they were up high on a boat or something, and I came in and somebody gave me a chair and. And Blake, and he saw me, his co-partner. I still don't remember.
Heston.
That's right. He saw me, and he told Gary that I was there, and he looked around. And then he finally came, and he sat down beside me, and we talked for about, 15 minutes. And then he saw me to my car, and that's the last time I saw him.
Was that sweet, bittersweet? Difficult?
No, it was, you know, it was nothing because I had children and I just wanted to see him one more time.
Great. I wanted to talk a little about Breaking Point one more time, about John Garfield. You had mentioned that he kind of gave direction to you, was telling you how to do it.
He was hysterical because I saw him at a party we went to. And he knew I was going to do that part, and he came and talked to me about it. And he was saying, trying to tell me how to play it. And he said, I better not tell you what he said because they were dirty words.
Tell us.
And
that's all right.
No, I can't.
The character you're playing is a whore.
Yeah, and he said, you fuck. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And I would say, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. And, oh, he, I mean, And I would try to when we were playing it, I told you I would try to touch him, but he was a good actor. He really was a good actor.
And was Michael Curtiz a good director?
I did two films with him, and he was good.
Now I want to talk about another director, Kazan, when you did A Face in the Crowd. Now right around that time, there was still a lot of talk about the McCarthyism and all that stuff going on. Did that have a big effect, do you think, on Kazan as a director and the acceptance of the film?
It was such a good film.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people were against Eli Kazan. And I loved it. I'm very sorry his position he took. He did not want to do it, but he couldn't help it, if that makes sense. I mean, he said, I'll never do it. But in the end, he succumbed and he told names. And that is very sad that he did it. But he was a great director, a heavenly man. And I really adored him. And everybody who worked with him must have. I know that some people who weren't working, but they resented what he did. It's very sad.
Do you think that's a wrong judgment to do, to judge somebody on their politics when it's really their work that you should be judging?
Well, I think same you're dead
with,
right.
Oh, same thing are. With Polanski last year winning the Oscar for The Pianist, that a lot of people objected to because of his, leaving the country under a dark cloud.
Oh.
But is that correct or not correct?
Well, I don't know what I'm talking about.
About Kazan being judged for his politics rather than what he put up on the screen.
Oh, but the Darling Other Man, I'm so bad with names, but the one who wrote...
Bud Schulberg. Who wrote
Face
in the Crowd.
He was the same thing happened to him.
Right.
I mean, he in the end, he talked. But, and I like him because he's in Martha's Vineyard in the summertime and I see a lot of him. But, I just think I know that people, when he was presented with a great award, some people, they sat on their hands. They did not intend. Well, why should we punish him that way? I mean, he's a fabulous director. And why should they think like they think? Or why should he think like they think, if that makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, one has to say, people, when you do something fabulous, you've got to get credit for it. And don't, just because you have a different opinion, don't let that impress you. Does that make sense?
Well said, yes. Very well said. You had once said, now jumping to HUD, you once said that you understood the part of Alma almost better than any character you ever played. What was there about Alma that you understood so well?
Well, she's Southern, and I'm Southern, no way. And I liked her attraction to him. And the fact she wasn't gonna succumb to him. And I love my little boy.
Brandon DeWilder.
And I love Melvin Douglas. They were beautiful people, and I just felt it, I mean, I didn't even have to work on it. I just knew what she felt, and I did it automatically. I that's the kind of actress I am. I'm not really a actor, studio actor. I mean, I think I've got to understand it because I just feel it, And if I feel it good, then it's good, and if it's... I act like that. I'm an instinctive actress.
Now, certainly that had to be one of the high points of your career, HUD. What are some of the high points? I know what they are to me, but what stands out to you?
About?
about any of your films that you that are meaningful?
Well, some I like doing, some I don't particularly like, but most of the time I love it. I am an actress, pure and simple. I love acting, and I'd love to have another job and tell everybody that.
What is it about acting you like so much?
I'm just an actress. It appeals to me. I feel it. That's me.
You think that's something born in one?
I think it is, yeah. I'm sure it is. Because, all the actresses I know were born that way.
When you see a film, say, like The Fountainhead.
And actors, too, but I don't mean to leave them out.
Say, like The Fountainhead or something else, In Harm's Way, we'll say, or Operation Pacific with John Wayne. Are you affected a lot by your feelings at the time you made the film, as opposed to the film that perhaps I would see going and seeing it pure and simple?
No, an actress is an actress. An actor is an actor. And you can, I wouldn't let my personal life infect me in any way. Is that what you mean?
Yes, I'm thinking probably, though, more when you look back on it, when you think of Operation Pacific. Do you judge it as the film that you saw when you saw it in a theater, or the memories of making it, which maybe were not so pleasant or were pleasant?
They weren't so pleasant.
Did you like John Wayne?
I did not like him that first time I worked with him. He was terrible. He was directing. He was trying to direct it, and I think he was breaking up with his wife, and he almost hit the publicity man. He really almost fist fought him. I mean, he was really terrible, and I didn't like him one bit. But then, years later, when I did In Harm's Way with him in Honolulu, we got along superbly. I really loved him because he was happily married then. He had children, and I loved his wife, and he was really super then. So my last impression was a very good one.
And you worked with Kirk Douglas on that.
Oh, I love Kirk Douglas.
Yeah, you had dated him for a while.
Yes, I did date Kirk.
And you just presented him with an award recently.
It was the Victory Award. And I had won it before, and I wanted him to do it. And they offered it to him and hadn't gotten an answer from him. So I wrote him a letter, and I said, Kirk, this is fabulous. You must do it. And he said he read that letter, and he said he'd do it. And he did that in the speech that he gave them. You should have been there. It was such a hysterically funny speech. He got laugh after laugh. I mean, he is witty, very witty.
Has he changed much during the years? You've known him for a long time.
Oh, yes. I don't see him, a lot of him now, but I loved him. He's a good man.
Uh-huh. You did two films with Ronald Reagan. Your first film, John Loves Mary, and also The Hasty Heart, that you did in England with him. Talk a little about him as an actor and as a person.
Well, I met Ronald Reagan when I first arrived in Hollywood, and it was New Year's Eve. About 2 days before that, I arrived, and I was invited to a fabulous party. And his wife, Jane Wyman, she just had said she was divorcing him because she had won the Oscar, and she thought she'd leave him behind. And I met him. He came in just before midnight, and he said, "Hi, we're going to do a film together." And I said, "Hello." Midnight, and he went outside with an older woman about 5 minutes before midnight, and he wept and wept and wept on her shoulder. He did not want a divorce. And then we did the John Loves Mary, and he was in an apartment, and we got along superbly. And then I did The Fountainhead, and then we did The Hasty Heart together, and we went for the grand royal performance,
and in England. That was, uh-huh.
And then we were side by side in the Savoy Hotel. We both had fabulous suites. And then I had the best one looking at the water, and he was next door to me, and he had a good one. And he hated England. He hated being there. He really didn't like it one bit. But and now, of course, they got to be very good friends. But I know that I used to go out with him a lot because I had somebody, and he was getting a divorce from her, and we went all the parties together, and we really got along splendidly, and it was very good. And then he caught the first plane out of there. He really hated it, but then I think I traveled on a boat then all the time. But he was, I'm very sorry that he is, what has happened to him, because he was a fabulous man. And the fact that he was so brilliant, he told stories. And I got so, I would say, oh, Ronnie, tell them this story. And he'd say, ho, 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 and he'd tell it. And they'd go, laughter, laughter. And then I'd say, Ronnie, tell him that story. So I was a cure of him. But he was really a superman.
Were you surprised when he got into politics and was so successful at it?
I was very, very surprised. I thought, what are they doing? I mean, you know, I just thought, he was very good. Very good indeed.
Did you see him much after he became president?
I was invited to the White House, and I sat at the table with him. I think there were about 8 or 10 people at the table, and I was across from him. And I made a great speech to him once from a thing. I went to the White House I think I was swimming about 3 times. Mm-hmm. 3 times.
I want to talk to you about, after your stroke, some of the things you did in the rehabilitation process that helped you get back to where you were. You had talked about your husband kind of not goading you on, but like kind of pushing you so that you weren't able to just sit back and just vegetate.
That's
that
right.
You actually got out. But what were some of the processes that you had to go through?
Well, forgive me, I hope I'm right in saying this. I may be wrong. But I do think that the fact that I had this stroke, I think people began to be more interested in it. And all kinds of hospitals went up, and all kinds of people to work with people who had strokes. And I do think I had a little something to do with it.
The because, high visibility
well,
you it, did.
It, well, I mean, practically nothing was done. They just died like that. But it's very important to have a hospital where you do exercises and your mind. And I love the hospital which is named after me because it's so good. And that there are fantastic hospitals around for strokes. People who have strokes is a horrible thing to have. You have no idea what you're just eaten alive, you know? And you have to work. Oh, you have to really work if you have a stroke, you know? And most people, some people, they have them and they can't speak. I mean, I've known 2 or 3 or 4 people like that, and I know that when I was in Florida at my mother's, and I was invited to a tea party, she said. And she came, picked me up, 2 women, and we were there. And when we were halfway there, another town completely, she said to me, "You're going to make a speech, and they're all coming to see you." Well, I could have slit her throat. I really could have. And I walked in the light, wherever it was.
You didn't know you were going to be giving?
No, I had no idea. I thought it was a tea party. And the chairs, they went upwards, you know, and I had flowers and a microphone. And I was so angry that I made the best speech I've ever made in my life. It was fantastic, and I said, I did not know I was invited to make a speech, but I was, and I will tell you what I can think of. And anyway, I got so many laughs. You've never seen anything like it. And I know this man on the first or second row, and he was going all the time. It was really, even though I could kill her for doing it to me, it was a great success, mm-hmm. the best I've ever had.
Well, you're such a, one of the great things about your acting has always been your honesty. I mean, you're a wonderfully honest actress, and you are as a person. I mean, it's such a pleasure to talk to you because you really tell what you feel like you feel it.
I do.
Were you always that way?
I think I've always been that way, you know. I've got myself in trouble a lot of times, but I just don't lie.
It's a great quality.
I hope. At times, no.
Just to finish that about the rehabilitation and everything like that, what gave you the idea that you could act again after that? Because you had a long period where you couldn't talk either, where you couldn't remember things.
Boy, words were so mixed up. It was just invented
words. Was that a slow process of coming back, or did a lot of that come back kind of in stages?
Oh, stages.
Yeah.
Oh, stages, I'm sure. But I was going to tell you something, and I forget what it was. What was that question you asked?
About the rehabilitation process, and when did you know that you could act again or remember lines again to take on something like the subject was roses?
Well, as I told you, I didn't want to do it, but my husband, he pushed me into it. And I'm so thrilled that he did, because I adore acting. I'm an actress from beginning to end, and that's really what I am. But was that going to say something else?
That I don't know. But did you not want to do it because you thought you couldn't do it, or you just didn't want to be pressured?
Oh no, I didn't trust myself at all. And Valerie Eaton Griffiths, she worked with me for a year to learn these lines, and. It was very good, but you know, I'd probably learn all the lines now, but you know, this is what happened years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different now, mm-hmm. very different, and I'm the best, you know, I still have faults, but I solve them. I mean, I don't walk divinely, and I can't see you now until I look at you, and then I see you, and what a lovely man you are.
But you don't let any of that stop you. That's what's so inspiring about all this. You don't let any of that get you down, and you've got that smile on your face all the time and that twinkle in your eyes. That's such an inspiring thing to all of us.
Well, you're so good to say so.
Well,
Thank you.
You know, and I don't like to ever dwell on the tragedies in your life, because I know that that's not what your life is all about.
Hmm.
It's been about acting and living your life and all of that, but it is such an inspiring thing to see somebody come through what you've come through and just be grabbing life and living life so wonderfully.
Well, get me a job.
Okay, you're on. Do you watch your old films?
Not a lot. If I happen to turn on television and it happens to be on, like, Bright Leaf was on, I watched that. But I don't watch it, I don't really see a lot of them.
Talk a little about Broadway, The Golden Years.
Oh, that I was asked to do this film, which I did. I think he came up to Martha's Vineyard, which is where I have a beautiful house, and he did me in the backyard. And there are masses and masses and masses of actors.
Talking about Broadway.
Yeah, it's either Broadway, it's films and Broadway, and it's just about actors and directors. It's a divine film, and I hope it will win the award.
For a documentary?
Yes, yes, it's beautiful.
Now, let me ask you something. Do you think that you're a strong person?
I think I am. I don't know. Who knows if you're strong or not? But I
well, you seem to have such great resilience and all of that.
Yes, I do have it. Of course, I succumb every now and then. I scream and yell and do all that. But I think I am a strong woman, I think.
Do you have a... I know that you go up to... is it a monastery where you go with...
Oh, yes, it's Abbey of Regina. Heart. Yes, Abbey of Regina Lourdes, and it's Mother Dolores Hart. She's the one that I went to see originally.
And you still kind of go up there? Is it for...
Oh, yes. Like, yeah, I just came back from there. I spent Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night there, and then because I couldn't leave because it was pouring with snow. But then I left on Saturday morning. My dear secretary, she drove up to pick me up.
Is that a very healing atmosphere up there when you're there?
Oh, it's gorgeous. I love it. I love it. I love it. And it's just so beautiful. And I think I began going in 79, 78 or 79. I think, am I right?
Mm-hmm. Let me think. Yep.
I think I've been going about 25 years, I think.
I just want to talk a little about your kids again, about their writing.
Ah.
Now, one of your daughters, I believe, is writing a book about her father.
Yes, the Sophia doll. And she is writing a superb book about Ruel.
About his life?
Yes, yes. It was from the beginning, you know. And then Tessa, my daughter Tessa, she's written two or three books. And then there's Lucy, and she's writing screenplays. And then there's my son Theo, who's working in a great grocery store now. He really does a wondrous job.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks
for being with us. It's so good to see you, as always. Continue good things for you.
I love you.
Thank you.